Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to this podcast on this wonderful Monday afternoon, nice and sunny here in Chicago. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Terry Dunlap. He is the co-founder and CSO, actually I should say Chief Strategy Officer, at one of the leading cybersecurity firms on the East Coast known as ReFirm Labs. They're based out of Fulton, Maryland. Terry, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Hey, Robbie, anytime. Glad to be here. Appreciate the invite. So I'm ready whenever you are.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Let's rock and roll here. So basically, now we did some snooping up on you, short of doing a background check from, like, you know, that one website I keep getting spam email from, My Life or whatever it's called. But, well, we did some Google searching. We looked you up on your website. We, you know, poked around you on LinkedIn, you know, and you seem to have a very interesting background, hacking in the 80s and then working for the NSA. Tell us about all this. You know, were you ever on the dark side of hacking and you come to the good side, kind of like Darth Vader? Or tell us about all this.
Yeah. Actually, I started back in the 80s on the dark side and got pulled over to the good side of the force, if you will. It was around the mid-80s, 1985, to be exact. I was a junior going on a senior in high school back in Ohio. Anybody who's a roller coaster enthusiast is probably familiar with the theme park Cedar Point. Well, that's my playground. That's where I grew up, Sandusky, Ohio. And during that time, I mean, computers weren't anything like they are today. There's really no internet. It was primarily 300 baud modems and dial-up bulletin board systems, the BBSs of the day. And one of the things that we got into were, you know, not only hacking computer games, which were built for the Commodore 64 on the big 5.5-inch floppy disks, but we also started getting into more nefarious things. We discovered the thrill of dumpster diving. And this is where we would actually go to the local mall and at 3-4 o'clock in the morning and pull out, if some of your listeners are old enough to remember, that credit cards used to have carbon copies back in the 80s. So anytime a credit card got swiped, you signed the piece of paper, you got a copy, the merchant kept a copy. And there was a carbon that sat in between, and they normally would take those carbons, rip them in half, and throw them in the trash. Well, we found value in those carbon copies, and so we would go to the local mall in the middle of the night, rip through all the garbage bags and the dumpsters, and pull out as many carbon copies as we could. And then we'd go back to my house or a friend's house, and we'd piece together these carbon copies to get full credit card numbers with expiration dates and names and all that stuff. So we would take those credit card numbers and not order stuff as most people would probably do. We actually uploaded those credit cards that we found locally to a bulletin board system out on the West Coast called The Well. And there were other people out on the West Coast who were doing the exact same thing we were doing, stealing credit card numbers from carbon copies and uploading those credit card numbers to the bulletin board system. So we would basically swap them. And, then we would use, in Ohio, we would use California-based credit card numbers to order things that stupid high schoolers would order, things like fireworks and just BS stuff that we thought, you know, we had fun with. That all came crashing down one day when the police actually said when we were arrested that I ran a crew. I wouldn't necessarily call it a crew. I just had a couple younger high schoolers that were tagging along with me and helping collect carbons. One of the guys decided to do this on his own without any coordination amongst the rest of us. And what he ended up doing, and this is what led to our downfall, he actually lived next door to a property where on the main front of the house, an older woman, her husband had just passed. And so she moved out of the house and left it vacant. However, in the back, there was a smaller house, a smaller unit that she rented out to a husband and wife. So this guy, that this kid that I was working with, he decided to approach the next door neighbor in the back in the rental unit and said, "Hey, if I order you a bunch of power tools, would you make sure that you accept UPS packages that come to the main house in front?" And so they struck a deal. So one day, the woman whose husband had died and left the main property was checking up on the house and discovered one of those yellow UPS was here stickers. Knowing that she didn't order anything, she notified the police and notified UPS. And so they decided to, okay, this has been happening for a while. They checked their records. We need to stake this place out. So they went ahead and put a sticker up there. Cops and UPS and the homeowner were in hiding somewhere. And then Tony, the kid I was working with, next door neighbor to this property, decides to walk out and pick up the notice that this package was ready. Well, when the police saw that, they went to Tony's house, knocked on his door, and said, "Can we come in?" Without a search warrant, he said, "Sure, come on in." Now, remember, he's 15 years old. What's he supposed to know about search warrants and searches and seizures? So they come in, and they go through his room, and they start reading and going through all this stuff, and they find a diary that he has been keeping, a journal, with everybody's real name in there for a couple of years. And we've been doing this probably since, you know, we were sophomores in high school. So what ends up happening is that he gets arrested. He squeals. I get arrested. The other guy gets arrested. And we actually get pulled out of school during the middle of the day and get taken down to the police station. And we get charged when we end up going to court. You got to remember, this is 1985. So in 1986, the following year, is when they passed at the federal level, the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So since there were no computer hacking laws on the books at the time, we just basically got off with 3 years probation and some court fines. So had it been 1 year later, you would probably be talking to me or from jail or from prison or not talking to me at all. So That was the teenage years.
Okay. Wow. Well, tell us more about, you know, like the NSA when you turn over to the good side.
Sure.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So, you know, it might surprise some of your listeners that in light of my interest and my background in computers and, you know, bulletin board systems and manipulating modems and stuff like that, I did not have an interest in pursuing, when I went to college, a degree in computer science or computer programming. It just seemed second nature to me, and it's something I just didn't want to pursue as a degree or a profession in the end. But I ended up graduating college with like a degree, a double major, poli-sci and econ of all things, and I actually went down the path of getting into the financial area and working with places like Fidelity Investments, where I was a trader and stuff for a while. One thing led to another, and I ended up, ironically, dealing with Deloitte & Touche, a consulting company. Everyone, I'm sure, has heard of the name Deloitte & Touche, on their investment side, handling money and portfolios and things like that. But I got to be really good friends with the IT guy. I told him my background of, you know, got arrested when I was a teenager, computer hacking. And again, got to put this in perspective. This is the early 90s. And he had mentioned to me one time, he said to this, he goes, "Are you still into that computer hacking stuff?" I said, "Well, no, not really. I mean, I have a lab now set up at my house where I kind of monkey around and do stuff. And yeah, I still have an interest in it. Why do you ask?" He said, "Did you know people actually get paid to break into companies nowadays?" I couldn't believe it. This is when penetration testing started to become a thing in the early 90s.
Right.
I said, "No, I had no idea. This sounds fascinating." He goes, "I can put you in touch with Deloitte's penetration testing team if this is something you think you'd want to look into." And, of course, I said yes. So I ended up making the switch. Went from their, you know, high-net-worth client division to actually becoming a penetration tester with Deloitte & Touche and hitting all the Fortune 500 companies like First Energy and Fifth Third Bank in Cincinnati and Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati and State Farm. So it was a good time. I mean, we basically, you know, get to come into these companies. We plug into the network. We sit in a conference room and we just hack away and try and find vulnerabilities, which was great. Of course, with a large company like that, you get a training budget. So I decided to use my training dollars one year to attend a SANS Institute training session. Now, those of you that are not familiar, SANS Institute is based here in Maryland, and they run a number of well-respected computer security tracks and learning programs and certificates and things like that. So I attended my first one around 2001, maybe 1999, 2000 timeframe. And we happened to be in a line at a, I guess it was like a Starbucks kiosk in the convention center. And I looked at this woman's name tag who was behind me. And I don't remember for the life of me what her name was, but I do remember it said that she worked for the DOD. I didn't know this woman. And I said to her, I would love to work for the DOD because you guys are probably under constant attack. And I bet that would be such a challenging environment to work in. So we got to talking, and by the end of the conference, she gave me her email address and said, send me your resume. My boss is always looking for good, talented people, and maybe I can make an introduction. So I figured, what do I got to lose? So I send her my resume when I get back, and for months I never hear anything from her again. So I kind of write it off as, you know, nothing big from that's going to happen. But I end up getting a call probably about 6 to 9 months later, saying, hey, you know, I haven't forgotten about you. I've given your resume to my boss. He's passing it on to the recruiting department. You're probably going to get a call here in the next few days. I just wanted to give you a heads up. Oh, great. I was looking forward to this. Well, I'm at work, Deloitte, and happen to be on an engagement at a client site, and I get a phone call, and I answer the call, and the gentleman says, you know, my name is John Smith or whoever he happened to be at the time. I'm a recruiter with the National Security Agency. Do you have a few minutes to talk about your resume? At this point, I was floored. I had no idea she worked for the NSA, this chance meeting I had at the security conference. So I did a phone interview with them. I apparently passed because they wanted me to fly out within the next few weeks to actually come out and do some face-to-face interviews with a number of groups. So I took them up on the offer, and by the time I was done going through a day's worth of interviews, I was basically given a stack, a significant stack of papers to fill out. And I was told, they're interested. Everyone that spoke to you is interested in having you come work for us. So you need to fill out this packet of information, which is called the SF-86. And anybody who's been in the intelligence community or has a security clearance knows what an SF-86 is. They want to know everything about you, your brothers, your sisters, your distant family members for like the past 10 years. Get this filled out, get it back to us, and then we can assess whether or not you can get a security clearance. So at this point, I'm thinking, oh man, do I tell these guys about my indiscretions as a teenager? I got to tell them because, I mean, come on, this is the NSA. They're going to find out. So I basically tell him, hey, look, I don't know if I can do this because this is what happened when I was a kid. And he said, hey, are you doing it today? And I said, no, I'm not. I got a lab at home, but I'm not doing this nefariously. He said, then don't worry about it. Fill it out. Get it back to us. About six, 9 months later, I get a call from him that I actually did pass the security background check, and I got a top secret clearance. And then I started working for the National Security Agency September 23rd, 2002.
Okay. Do you have any exciting stories you can share from the NSA, like any cloak and dagger stories or anything? Because I know I've interviewed a lot of hackers in the past, and they always like to – it's kind of like a James Bond kind of thing, you know what I mean? There are a few pen testers I know they don't like having their pictures, you know, up on LinkedIn and so forth. So it's kind of like a James Bondonian kind of thing, you know, with some of my subscribers, you know, that they think penetration testing is like XXX or 007, you know, spy who loved me, you know, that kind of thing. But do you have any like exciting cloak and dagger stories you can share with us that's not classified or anything? Or
I can. I think the most interesting thing is what I actually ended up doing in some of the targets and missions we were going after. I mean, each one of these has a unique story to it that I probably can't get into the details of. But in essence, when I started at the agency, even though I was in my mid to late 30s at that point, I came in as what they called an intern. And what ends up happening is that you are supposed to kind of travel around to different branches within the agency every 6 months to see where you might want to call home at the end of this three-year internship. Well, some of the places I ended up going were okay. It was a lot of more or less like report generation, nothing really technical. So it didn't really strike me as being fulfilling at these different offices or branches that I went to until one day I actually ended up in TAO, which used to be not known by the public, but thanks to Edward Snowden and others, we now know that TAO stands for Tailored Access Operations. And when I had a tour of Tailored Access Operations, that's where I found out that all the hacking takes place, the offensive hacking. And I loved it there. And so I spoke to my branch chief and my team leader at the end of my three-month stint there saying, look, I still have a year and a half of this internship left to fulfill, but I want to stay here. I don't want to do this anymore. Can you guys help me get out of this program? So they did. So I ended up becoming a permanent full-time government employee with Tailored Access Operations. Now our mission, I can't get into the specifics, but we got to remember that this was during the height of the Iraq War. So we had a lot of military personnel forward deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq, and we were supporting JSOC, which is the Joint Special Operations Command. These are the elite of the elite military, and these guys were going out. Their mission was to go out and wrap up high-value terrorist targets, or known as HVTs. And one of the things that we were really good at, my group and myself, was identifying, or I should say, once the intelligence came from the field, what types of devices, electronic devices, these guys were using, we would actually find vulnerabilities in the firmware of these devices and help the special forces leverage those vulnerabilities so they could track them better, and then eventually apprehend them or kill them. So that's where we started, dealing with firmware a lot and helping them achieve their specific mission. Now, the other thing you have to remember, too, is that the stated goal of the U.S. National Security Agency is long-term signals intelligence collection. So basically that means sucking up data in foreign countries on the Internet, off of satellites, off of cell phones, and just amassing this data and then analyzing it. Well, what we were doing, the work was very tactical. So we would hear that the military is going out to actually find a specific target. They knew he was using certain types of devices, and they needed ways to track those devices. And so they would come to us. We would come up with a solution before they deployed, whether it was 30 or 60 days from now, and then they would go out and do their mission. So what we were doing was very, very tactical in nature, which goes against the grain of the agency's long-term SIGINT collection mission. And we were basically told, look, you guys got to stop doing what you're doing. Shocking, I know, even though we were successful. And focus more on the long-term collection mission and not this tactical one-off stuff. So I was kind of upset because I thought we were all in the same, global war on terror here, and yet we're not sharing our capabilities. You're telling us not to support these guys who are putting their asses on the line and going out, being forward deployed, trying to wrap up these terrorist targets. So I just said, I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave and start my own company. I'm going to develop these hacking tools as an outsider and sell them back to the military who was using them. And so that's what I did. And that was in 2007 is when I left the NSA. And I started my first company, which was Tactical Network Solutions, which still exists today. and it does offensive cyber capabilities for not only now the U.S. government, but also the Brits, the Aussies, the Israelis. We've done some work with the Canadians. So, yeah, we do a lot of cool offensive cyber stuff that, you know, I'm glad I took that risk to do that. That's kind of the whole genesis of being the teenage hacker to starting this company here. And if you're interested, I can go into another company I started after Tactical Network Solutions. That's more on the defensive side if you want to go down that road too.
Yeah, can you give us a little more insight? Your background is so fascinating. You're the first, first to go from the dark side and the good side of ethical hacking. You're the first pen tester I've actually – so it's really intriguing. So, yeah, give us a little bit more detail about that.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that over the years that we had been asked to work on from our various government customers – and now you got to remember, IoT in the early, you know, mid-2000s really wasn't a thing yet. It was just catching on. But to us, it always existed. It just was known under a different moniker known as embedded systems. So embedded systems have always been around. For whatever reason, they just started calling these embedded systems IoT devices around 2000 and 9 or 10 or so. So we were really good at being able to find vulnerabilities that could be weaponized in these, you know, embedded or IoT devices. And, you know, governments had us, you know, looking to help them stockpile zero-day vulnerabilities that could be weaponized for offensive purposes. So when a lot of that contractual work started to slow down, we had this capability that we automated where we could rapidly identify potential vulnerabilities that could be weaponized in about 30 minutes in most IoT devices. Now, prior to this, this all used to be done by hand using open source tools like one of my guys created called Binwalk, which is very popular. It basically unpacks a firmware image into its underlying operating system. Think of it like a zip file. So think of a firmware as a zip file, and Binwalk allows you to unzip that zip file to give you all the contents. So that was an open source tool that still exists today, very popular. So that was a manual process, having to develop this code to unzip the firmware. Well, now that you have the firmware unzipped, now you have to go through and look at the web server and the mail server, if there is one, or whatever other binaries are on there to look for vulnerabilities. And there could be hundreds of binaries in one particular firmware image. And I kept asking my team, how can we automate this? So over the years, you know, bits and pieces started to become automated until we got it down to the point where we could go to a manufacturer's website, grab a piece of firmware, put it in the platform in 30 minutes, tell us where the potential insecure areas are that we might be able to turn into a zero-day exploit. Well, all that work kind of slowed down, and we thought, well, I wonder if there's somebody else out in the market that would find this platform, this capability, interesting. So there was a tech breakfast startup meeting. I guess they were pretty popular around at least the East Coast for a while. And so we did a pitch. We went and pitched for about 7 minutes and then offered, you know, questions for about three. And we were approached afterwards by a group of investors that said, hey, have you ever thought about using this platform for defensive purposes instead of offensive? Well, no, we didn't, because we got so much joy and excitement out of being on the offensive side. Why would we ever want to be a defender? Because on the offensive side, we only have to be right one time. But we listened to them for about 3 months, talked about the burgeoning IoT market, how all this stuff's insecure, and how we probably would have significant customer base and a completely different set of clientele, and even make more money if we, you know, sold this platform to people like, you know, telecommunications providers or equipment manufacturers who are building these IoT devices. So we said, okay, we'll take a flyer on this and let's see what happens. So we took the core team that built that platform, and we called that platform Centrifuge. And we spun that and the team, the core team, out of Tactical Network Solutions, took some seed investment from these investors of about $1.5 million, and then created a brand new company called Refirm Labs, completely separate from Tactical Network Solutions that does all the spooky offensive cyber stuff. And now we have Refirm Labs, which is strictly focused on helping companies and manufacturers find these vulnerabilities before they even get put into products in production. So we've taken the company and, you know, we got the offensive side that still deals with the government stuff. And now we have Refirm Labs, which does defensive stuff by highlighting these vulnerabilities and these weaknesses in an attempt to help manufacturers secure their stuff before they actually get produced and put out into the wild.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'm talking about your company, Refirm Labs. So tell us how you kind of segued into that. What was the catalyst for that? And obviously, as a founding partner, you probably have ownership of the company, obviously. So tell us more about it, like how long it's been in business, how big your operations are. You know, do you have any operations overseas? Yeah, give us more insight into that, please.
Yeah, so the company, we spun that out in the summer of 2017. We were kind of in stealth mode until that November of 2017, when we actually produced a research report at the time that took a look at five different very popular consumer devices, Wi-Fi routers, security cameras, baby monitors, those types of things. And one of the things that actually put us on the map when we came out of stealth in November was one of the devices that we looked at was a Chinese manufactured surveillance camera by a company in China called Dahua. Now, Dahua is the number two largest surveillance camera manufacturer in China. The number one manufacturer is Hikvision, and there is a Wall Street Journal article that discovered that the Chinese government owns 42% of Hikvision, who makes surveillance cameras. Well, we were approached during our stealth phase at Refirm Labs by a very well-known Fortune 500 company who happened to have a significant number of Dahua cameras all over their properties around the world. And the chief digital security officer at the time, ironically, happened to also be a former member of the intelligence community who had a very keen focus in his intel days focused on China. So he kind of knew, he had dirty knowledge, he kind of knew some of the things that the Chinese were capable of. He just didn't have any. And so he approached us and said, hey, can you guys look at these Dahua cameras we have all over our corporate headquarters and all around the globe? Let us know if you find anything. So we got a hold of one of the cameras. And we, you know, got a hold of the firmware, reverse engineered it with our platform. And we found a back door in the camera. And it wasn't accidental. Now, you got to keep in mind that when we find back doors in IoT firmware or embedded devices, the vast majority of the time, they're accidental. It's usually an engineer who put one in for remote testing and forgot to take it out during production. Why quality assurance didn't pick up on that, who can explain? But by and large, they're mostly accidental. And you can tell. It's pretty obvious. But this one didn't look accidental. And in fact, it almost looked kind of hidden, obfuscated in a sense, that it wasn't meant to be discovered. So we told the Fortune 500 customer, I said, hey, look, this is what we found. We found this back door. You better let your security operations center know that they should be monitoring any traffic going to and from China from these cameras. There shouldn't be any traffic going to China from these cameras or coming into China from these cameras. So just be aware. And I kid you not, Ravi, within about less than 48 hours, maybe 36, I got a text message from our customer, and he said, you guys were spot on. Look what we found. And he attached a firewall log, and it showed traffic leaving this corporate network out through the security cameras going to Chinese IP addresses. So, needless to say, they blocked that traffic. They shut those things down, and it took them almost a month to get the proper authorities and authorities to start ripping out those cameras and replacing them with something more American-made. So in this meantime here, so now that we have this information, we actually approach Dahua, contact them, say, hey, look, this is what we found. We're getting ready in November to go public with this. Do you want to have time to fix it or comment on it? And we didn't hear anything. Didn't hear anything for weeks. So our investors who had connections at Fortune and Forbes and Washington Post and Wall Street Journal and others kind of prepositioned the fact that we were coming out of stealth as this new company, Refirm Labs, and look what we found with these Chinese cameras. So we told all the reporters who were interested in running the story. We reached out to Dahua. We didn't hear anything. So they run the story. We publish our report. And probably within 24 hours, I get an email from some executive who handles U.S. sales from Dahua telling us that we examined the wrong firmware image. And in this email, he sends me a link to click on to get the most recent updated firmware image. Now, I'm sure you and your listeners know that one of the things you should never, ever do is to click on links and emails from people you don't know. And layer on top of that, that it came from China.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to say, buddy, I'm not clicking on your link.
I mean, I'm in cyber and I've been writing, I write about this stuff all the time. And believe it or not, about, I think in December, I almost became a victim of the phishing attack on PayPal. I mean, the email was so legitimate and the link there, it mirrored exactly the same thing. It was scary. So once I hit that link, I'm going, oh my God, what am I doing here? So I called PayPal and said, oh, we didn't send you an email. I'm going, great. So, you know, immediately, you know, do the things, you got to change your password, blah, 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 you know. So, yeah, so sorry to interrupt there, but yeah, that just shows, you know, anybody can fall for a phishing thing, even, you know, cybersecurity people too, you know, so.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that I've come to adopt and just drive home personally with myself is no matter where the email comes from, whether it's, you know, your end of month credit card statement, click here to download the statement now, or anything coming from any company I have a relationship with, if they send me an email with a link that I'm supposed to click to access something, whether it's my account or a statement or to pay a bill, I'm sorry, I don't click on them. I just open up a new tab in the browser and just go there directly myself to the main login page and then try and figure out where they wanted me to go to log in that way. That way I avoid it. I'm trying to convince my wife to do the same thing. Do not click on the links in the email. I don't care, even if it's from me. Just go to another tab, open it up, and try and find what, you know, they're trying to direct you to. But, so back to the story here. It took our guys quite a long time to actually find the firmware on Dahua's support page that they were referring to. Now, if this was truly an update, a recent firmware image that their customers were supposed to download and install, you think it would have been easier to find, but needless to say, it wasn't. But we found it, and we downloaded it directly and put it in our platform. So the good news is that the back door we had discovered was gone. Kudos for that. However, what we did find that same back door just moved in a different location in the firmware. So once they were called out that we had discovered the back door, they thought they could get away with keeping it in there simply by moving it someplace else within the firmware. And I even told him in a follow-up email, and I gave him all the technical screenshots of how our team discovered it. We gave them the exact disassembly code that we were able to find in IDA Pro, which is a professional disassembler, and pointed step by step, this is where we found it. This is what this program does. It's not gone. How do you explain that? And he told me, in an email, which I still have, that his lead engineer or coder or whoever his title was assured him that that piece of code had been removed. And then my final reply to him was, are you sure he works for you and not your government? And I never heard a word back. So let me put this in context real quick. Let me rewind the clock to about 2013. In 2013, this is way before ReFirm Labs existed. This was still at Tactical Network Solutions. We were contacted by a large British telco. And that telco was considering distributing brand new wireless routers, the next generation of wireless routers, to their customer base. They're currently in the contracting phase of this, so it's not built and ready for distribution yet, but they kind of knew our area of expertise with firmware and knowing that, you know, we know how to weaponize these vulnerabilities we find. They asked us not to weaponize something, but find out if there's any shenanigans going on in this firmware. So we said, okay, sure, we'll take a look at it. So we looked at it, and it was one of those, as I mentioned previously, engineering backdoors. It was pretty obvious. It's like, look, one of the test engineers probably forgot to take out this remote backdoor. Just tell the manufacturer to take it out, and you should be good to go. So about 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, customer reaches back to us again and says, hey, here's the updated version. Can you guys take a look at this again for us? So we take a look at it. And sure enough, firmware's gone. I mean, the backdoor's gone. However, it's just placed in a different location in the firmware. That's the first time we had seen that in 2013. So we asked this British telco. I said, this is really odd. I mean, they took it out of where we found it. They just moved it someplace else, which is really strange. Who, can I ask you, who is this vendor? And at the time, I've never heard of this vendor. They said it was Huawei. So here's what I want you and your listeners to consider. 2013, we find a backdoor in a piece of telecommunications gear manufactured by Huawei. It's discovered, and upon discovery, their solution is to just move it someplace else in the hopes that it wouldn't be seen. Not very sophisticated. I mean, like I said, when we looked at it, it looked like your traditional engineering account that was just left behind. Fast forward to 2017. Now you're dealing with another Chinese manufacturer in a completely different vertical, surveillance cameras, using a more sophisticated backdoor, who, when discovered, utilizes the same tactic that was utilized in the manufacture of telecommunications gear. What are the odds that the discovery of a backdoor and then being moved elsewhere in the firmware on two different devices in two different verticals from two different manufacturers doesn't involve some type of central coordination? Food for thought.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you have any customer success stories that you like to share with us from about ReFirm, or who's your typical customer base? Are you trying to go after the SMBs, the Fortune 500, or any industry verticals you specialize in? If you got any success stories, can you share them with us?
Yeah. So, you know, our team's still pretty small. It's 9 people. And we've seemed to have really good success, surprisingly, in the telecommunications space. Maybe not surprisingly, because we've looked at some telecommunications gear in the past. But our most well-known customer is AT&T. For those people that did not know this, as I didn't know it until they became a customer, AT&T is actually building out a separate, dedicated communications network devoted to first responders, called FirstNet. And one of the things that AT&T is doing with our platform is, you know, AT&T is not building all this equipment themselves. They reach out to other manufacturers, whether it's like Cradlepoint or some of the other large telco providers like Aris Communications, and they're basically, you know, contracting with these companies to build the gear that's going to create the first responder network. So one of the security checks that AT&T implements as part of this procurement process for this gear coming onto this new network is a firmware check. They will actually request from the manufacturers, the vendors, a copy of the firmware to be run through the Centrifuge platform. Now, this is in addition to numerous other security checks that they have implemented, but at the firmware level, they're able to identify sloppy coding practices that could lead to vulnerabilities that might be exploited. They look to make sure that any embedded crypto material, whether they be private keys, public keys, even SSL certs, are valid. None of them are expired or shouldn't be there. They use the platform to look for the accidental or purposeful backdoors, hard-coded usernames and passwords that might exist on there. The platform also helps them detect brand new equipment that they're receiving that already has publicly well-known vulnerabilities. You'd be shocked at how many devices that are brand new today out on the market, particularly at the consumer level, that have 25, 50, 100 plus already well-known vulnerabilities in the new product, because a lot of these people are using open source packages to build these products. So AT&T is using it to find all these things. And if they find anything like that, then they push back on the vendor, hand them a report from Centrifuge and say, we can't accept this until you address these problems. And ironically, we've seen an uptick in the actual vendors that AT&T is using for their first responder network coming to us with requests to help them because they're getting these reports from AT&T saying they won't accept our stuff because they're running this test on it, and this is what the test is finding, and supposedly you are the guys who are responsible for this platform running this test. How can we run this test before we actually give it to AT&T so we make sure we're giving them something clean, something healthy, something that they will actually sign off on? So we got AT&T on one hand using it to vet and validate these pieces of gear before they come in. And then on the other hand, we got the actual suppliers themselves coming to us saying, hey, we want to, you know, run our stuff through your system before we give it to AT&T to make sure that it's clean and doesn't get kicked back to us. So, you know, we got AT&T, Charter Communications. We're working right now with some nonprofit groups in the cable industry. So telecom, cable seems to be our sweet spot right now. But we've started to see an uptick in interest from oil and natural gas, energy companies, basically critical infrastructure type firms, and then your pen testers. The people that are actually engaged in pen testing usually are familiar with Binwalk, which is our open source firmware extraction tool, and they find out about Centrifuge, how the platform can be a force multiplier. Instead of having to go out and hire a team of reverse engineers, they can just subscribe to this platform and get the equivalent of a handful of reverse engineers that can give them actionable results within about 30 minutes. So we're starting to get some traction in the pen testing security consulting space as well.
Excellent. Now let's get into your product a little bit more. The Centrifuge platform, how's it used? How is it available? Is it pretty much all cloud? Is it an SaaS, software as a service deployment? Can you go into more detail, please?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, it is a platform. When we initially launched in 2017, it was strictly cloud-based. It's very intuitive to use. Has a user interface where you just drag and drop a firmware image that you're interested in analyzing. Provided some metadata information like the make, model, version number of the firmware that you're analyzing, and up into the cloud it goes. And in about 30 minutes, you'll get a detailed report. It'll actually extract the entire underlying operating system and file system. So if for whatever reason you need to download a specific component, you can do that very easily, or you can download a tarball image of the entire firmware image directly to your desktop. Then we have a section that highlights what we call high-risk executables, and you can drill down to the exact line of code in a specific binary that we think is ripe for potential exploitation. So I don't want to get too geeky on you and your audience, but for anybody that's a programmer, some of the things we look for are like buffer overflow and command injection attacks. So for the programmers in the audience, one of the things we look for is the use of stir copy, which can lead to a buffer overflow attack, as opposed to its more secure cousin, stern copy. The only difference is that there's an N in the name of the function call. One's much more secure. So we get down into the weeds, into the nitty-gritty, and show you exact lines of code that could be potentially exploitable. Now, here's the thing to keep in mind. We do not have access to the source code, okay? What we are analyzing is the compiled binary image of the firmware. So the firmware contains multiple text files, multiple config files, shared libraries, and executable binaries. And we're looking at all the executable binaries basically by disassembling the assembly code and then backing our way into what the actual function calls are. So I mean, that's just one part of it. That was the part that we relied on at Tactical Network Solutions to help us find exploitable vulnerabilities. But since then, we've added things like I mentioned earlier, extracting all the crypto material, private keys, public keys, SSL certs. Now, here's an interesting side note. A number of times we have taken a manufacturer's firmware image, whether it be a D-Link, a NetEar, Linksys, some of these, you know, Wi-Fi routers and devices most of us have in our homes. And we have been able to, even though the manufacturer says that they encrypt their firmware, what we have found is that the decryption key is actually baked into the firmware itself. So we are able to extract the private key, and we are able to extract the firmware. In addition, we've had some manufacturers who actually take the extra step to securely sign their code. So if you try to install it on a device, it's going to look for the signing key to make sure it was signed by the vendor so it's legitimate. It's kind of a security measure. But what we have found in some cases is that private signing key that you should always keep to yourself and never should be released publicly, that private signing key has been found inside these various firmware images from manufacturers. And so we were able to demonstrate one time where we could take the private signing key, and this was actually done on a vehicle. We were able to take the private signing key, modify the firmware to make it do stuff that we wanted to, sign it with that key we found as the original manufacturer, and then flash it back onto the vehicle. And the vehicle happily accepted it because we had the private signing key, which we found in the firmware. And so we demonstrated to the customer. Now, they're thinking, okay, private signing key, I don't even know what this crypto stuff is. So what? So what can you do as an attacker? Who cares? So we showed them. When we modified the firmware, signed it as that vendor, put it back on the vehicle, we started it up and showed them that when you turn on the right turn signal, the left one blinks, and vice versa. The left signal, the right one blinks. Or how about we turn on some air conditioning and have the heat blast out, or turn on the heat and have the AC blast out? And so now look, we can be a little more nefarious and a little more evil, but I think you get the point of why your supplier should not be putting his private signing key in his firmware image. So those are the things the platform is able to find as well. And as I mentioned, you know, we're able to identify already well-known, publicly documented vulnerabilities. Here's another side note. We have seen, and we have examples of this all over our database, where a brand new product comes out on the market. We will put the firmware through our platform, and we will find that platform, that device, already has an open SSL exploitable vulnerability in it that dates back to, get this, 2007. Why is a product in 2019, 2020 being delivered with 8-10-year-old vulnerabilities still baked into it? There's no, that is unacceptable. There is no need for that to happen, but yet we see it happen all the time with consumer devices. And it's just a matter of time before people of more nefarious means find what we're finding and decide to turn it into the next botnet attack of some sort. So these are the things that our platform is able to find. Like I said, we got most of our customers in the telecom space. It's a subscription-based platform. Like I said, when we initially launched it, it was cloud-based. But based on various customer interests, we've actually come up with different deployment options now as well. So in addition to the cloud model that's out there, we have private cloud. So if you run your own AWS or Google or whatever cloud, Azure, you know, we can actually deploy it on your own private cloud. And then we also have an air gap version for those people who are very concerned about intellectual property, or, you know, if you're in the military or in the intelligence community, you want it completely separated from the internet. So we offer an air-gapped version as well. So those are all the different flavors, and it's a subscription-based platform, all you can eat. You can subscribe to it, and it seems to be gaining traction. Not a lot of people are familiar with firmware yet. We don't see a lot of headlines about firmware as an attack vector, but they are ticking up.
Well, I mean, I think with firmware, I mean, I have seen some headlines on that. You know, I think I've seen something about Intel and AMD. I think they were being hacked into with their firmware. But I think we're going to, Terry, I'll be interested with firmware. I think we're going to see a lot more of this as attacks on critical infrastructure really start to pick up, I think, right? If I'm correct, if my analogy
absolutely.
Is correct.
You're 100%
really,
spot on.
Right. Now, I've got to be honest, your company is very unique. I've never come across any cyber firms in my podcast, and I've done like 50 podcasts already with other cyber vendors that do what you do. So what's your competitive market space like? I mean, I wouldn't think there'd be too many people out there doing what you do. Am I correct? Could you go into more detail about that?
Yeah, there aren't a lot of direct competitors, but there is interest in terms of venture capitalists funding security companies in the firmware space. So right now, our biggest competitors in terms of firmware analysis are, there's a couple open source projects that are out there. I think one is called Firmalizer and one's called Firmadyne. One might actually have been turned into a business now, but I think one's out of Belgium, and another one is basically a research project. Now, there are companies out there that have received funding in the firmware space. One of them is Eclipsium, which is run by a former Intel threat research gentleman, Yuri. I can't remember Yuri's last name. But anyway, he received some funding. And while they focus on firmware as well, they're also very niche focused in terms of the firmware that runs a lot of your servers that are in the cloud. So think like IBM servers, or like you were talking about Intel and AMD type chips. They're looking at that type of firmware. They released some very interesting research about a year ago now that showed when you actually contract with somebody like IBM's cloud services and provision some type of service in their cloud infrastructure. And let's say after some set amount of time, you decide that your company no longer needs that cloud capability. So you should have the option to go in there and blow everything away, erase everything that was on there, and then the next customer could come in and set up their instance in IBM's cloud space. So it's basically like as soon as you're done renting the space, they basically rent it out to somebody new. Well, what Eclipsium discovered is that they were able to, from a firmware level attack, be able to go in and still find valid copies of critical intellectual property other information that was originally on that server from the previous tenant. Basically, what they were saying is that you think you're wiping the server clean before it gets rented to the next person, but it's not. Somebody with enough skill and sophistication can come in and basically grab everything that you had on that server, even though you think you wiped it out. So that's the kind of firmware area that they specialize in. Now, there are other companies out there. Armis was one, I think, out of Israel that recently acquired for a significant sum. Their IoT solution required they were more of a defender in terms of having agents sit on your network, and they would take an inventory of your corporate network and identify all the IoT devices. And then they would monitor network traffic to those IoT devices. And if they saw something that was suspicious or out of the ordinary, they were able to, I think, generate on-the-fly firewall rules and basically put up a barrier of protection around that IoT device. Then there's another company out there called Red Balloon, I think, that found its origins in maybe some military contracts or from DARPA. Not too sure, but headed by some academics. And their claim to fame, I believe, is the ability to identify weaknesses in the firmware, say in a Cisco switch, identify that it's possibly under attack, and then basically on the fly rewrite the firmware somehow in memory to provide a defensive mechanism around it. So of all the solutions that I just kind of briefly highlighted, all these solutions in my mind are reactionary. You have already become a target of somebody, and they are coming after you. And so these devices and all these other solutions are very reactionary. Oh, there's an attack or something looks suspicious. Now we take action. What we try to do is we don't require source code. We do not sit on your network. We don't deploy agents. What we do is tell you if the firmware is vulnerable, and if so, where and what the weaknesses are. So I highlighted a number of things just beyond the code that we look at, looking at crypto material, looking at already known vulnerabilities, other things that we look at. Those other platforms don't do that. I don't think that was their intent. What we were doing is, remember the origins, we were coming at this from an offensive point of view, where we were trying to find ways to break into these pieces of firmware. So we just basically flipped the hat around and said, okay, well, this is what we would look for. Let's see if we can find it. And if so, let's report it to the end user so they're well aware of it. So we try to be more proactive instead of reactive like all the other solutions out there. So if somebody's looking for a firmware security solution and they want it to be reactionary, plenty of competition out there depending on what level of detail you want to go. If you're looking to prevent these attacks, if you're looking to simply prevent becoming a target in the first place, that's where we can come in. We can help you make sure that you deploy firmware that is secure from the get-go. So if there's some script kiddie or nation-state actor scanning networks or scanning the internet, looking for devices that are running certain protocols or open ports that could be vulnerable, we want to make sure that you don't show up on their radar screen.
Okay. Now, we've talked about the commercial sector, using your stuff. Does the federal government, I'm sure they've got to have a lot of intrigue in what you do too, right? Are they your customers?
Yeah, in fact, we just recently received a $1 million award from the Air Force. They want us to... Yeah, thank you. They want us to help mitigate supply chain risk in aircraft, fighter aircraft. So as you can imagine, the Lockheeds and the Boeings of the world, they don't manufacture all these, fighter aircraft themselves. They have an extensive chain of suppliers, and a lot of those suppliers are overseas. So the military and the government is acutely aware of how they might be attacked, not necessarily directly at Lockheed or Northrop or Boeing, but in the supply chain. So as these flight components come in, they want to have a system in place that can vet and validate the security of these embedded components before they even get assembled into the aircraft. So that's where we come in. Now, one of the reasons that we received the award is because of our, of course, historical nature of being offensive, nation state sponsored, and understanding that need. Part of that money is going to be used to develop a capability for our centrifuge platform to analyze, vet, and validate real-time operating systems. So our platform today operates on Linux-based firmware images. And
cool.
So we can look at things – we can look at things that run on ARM, MIPS, x86, 64, QNX, Super H. But the military, those flight systems aren't running Linux in most cases. Those are running a real-time operating system, which is usually for very critical needs, and the timing has to be exact. So we're talking things like VxWorks. Maybe some of your listeners are familiar with VxWorks. FreeRTOS, things of that nature. ECOS is another one that we came across. So we're going to be using some of this award from the Air Force to actually start supporting VxWorks and other real-time operating systems that would not only help us with the government, but would also help us get into more critical infrastructure systems as well, because a lot of critical infrastructure runs on real-time operating systems too.
Wow, that's awesome. That's incredible. Now, let's see here. Now, let's just segue over into the cybersecurity threat landscape in general. We keep hearing about nation-state threat actors, and, of course, not to pick on you all the time, but you were on the dark side once. You know, we hear about North Korea, China, Russia, blah, blah, blah. You know, now in their sphere, you know, with the presidential election coming up here in 2020, you know, that there's going to be sort of, you know, interfering. And there's another cyber threat coming out there, too. It's called deepfakes. And that's when you use artificial intelligence to actually mimic or create, like, a real-life, like, video, like Donald Trump asking for donations. You know what I'm talking about?
Yep. I've seen some of these. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and a big fear that it could be used for, like, phishing campaigns where it'll lure in, like, you know, honest Americans, you know, that just want to donate to the political party of their choice, but, you know, there's strong fear this could be sent to some bank account in China, you know, and the FBI may never even be able to recover the money. I mean, what are your thoughts on that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, deepfakes are a brand new threat vector. They're supposedly, I have yet to see this, supposedly there's some free software out there that you can download that actually allows you, the average user, to create your own deep fakes. All you need are some video clips of who you want to pretend to be and some photos. Yeah. I have to look this up and see, but I had a couple reporters locally here contact me about if we could actually do a demonstration for a newscast one on deep fakes. It's just not our wheelhouse. It's not what we do, but I understand the fascination for wanting to do a news piece on that, but it has nothing to do with firmware. But the threat's real. The threat's real, and the threat actors are real. Just like you rattled off, you got China, Iran, North Korea, to name a few. Now, I just gave you and your listeners a perfect example of what we've encountered with China many years apart, 2013 versus 2017, with the back doors becoming more sophisticated as time goes on, but yet the tactic is still the same. Once it's discovered, let's move it someplace else so maybe they won't notice. I mean, this is just one tactic of many. And, you know, this is continuing to occur today. Now, my biggest problem is the recent news last week, I think it was last week, that the Johnson government, Boris Johnson over in the UK, has decided to allow certain portions of their 5G network to be to agree to use Huawei equipment. And this is just shocking. I mean, I've had a number of reporters, and there's even a piece in Foreign Policy magazine that quotes me about how this is setting the wrong precedent. Just because somebody like a Huawei can come in who's subsidized by the government to come in and offer these ridiculously low prices that no normal competitive company could match, is you have to avoid the temptation of just buying it because of the price. Once these companies like a Huawei come in at these hugely subsidized prices and gain a foothold into your infrastructure, even though it's not touching the core of the network, it's just the edge devices that are out there, what happens when some of those second from the tier edge devices start to show their age or can no longer keep up, or the core itself needs to be replaced? Do you think you're going to go to your Cisco or Junipers or Ericsson or Nokia or whoever happens to be the trustworthy provider to replace that gear? I would say money has a big part to do with it. And China's out to play the long game. These guys can wait for decades for their policies and their strategies to be implemented. You and I, Robbie, will be long gone. And I strongly believe that in time, because Huawei has its foot in the door now with the UK government, that it's just going to be a matter of time before Huawei spreads its tentacles throughout the entire UK infrastructure. And then it will be owned by Huawei equipment, which will give, in my estimation, the Chinese government direct access to all communications within the UK. And in light of this, what happened last week, I bet other countries around the world are going to follow the exact same path just because of the cost. Just because they can get their 5G networks up faster at a cheaper cost than dealing with an Ericsson or a Nokia or some other international provider of 5G gear. And it's going to be a move that you and I will never see the end result, because it'll happen maybe 30, 40, 50 years from now, where the Chinese government controls the vast infrastructure of the world's global communications networks.
Wow. Now, we had spoken about the Internet of Things. I think we may briefly touch on it earlier in our show. I honestly find the IoT a very scary thing. I hate it. I don't like it, because I'm kind of an old-fashioned kind of guy. I mean, honest, although I'm in cyber, I hate technology. we're so much inundated by it every day. And, I mean, I only have, like, 2 mobile apps on my cell phone. I hate mobile apps. I don't use it. In fact, I've got an old Honda Civic from 2003. It's good old analog instrumentation, but still working, you know. My financial advisor, he's got, like, one of these smart cars where he just claps his hand and the damn thing just rolls out, you know, from the parking lot. It's like, geez, you know, talk about James Bond here, you know. But anyway, yeah, it's this interconnectivity. I mean, it just increases the attack surface for the cyber attacker. And I believe that the connections are used are what, RFID, I believe. And it's so insecure. What are your thoughts on the IoT in general? And do you have a smart home?
No, I do not have a smart home for a lot of the same fears that you have. I know too much, and you know, I'm going to be called a hypocrite here, I know. So let me state my case. When the Alexas came out, the Echoes and the Alexas and the Dots and Google's Assistant and the Home Hub, and people are putting these devices in their homes so they can order stuff on Amazon or play trivia games or contact their kids in the upstairs bedroom without having to get up or shout throughout the house, use these devices as intercom systems, whatever people use them for. The bottom line is, whether they you know it or not, and I think your audience is probably sophisticated to know this, that these devices are always listening. And early on, when I would mention that to people, it's like, oh, no, it's not always listening. You're starting to see more and more crime stories out where a murder happens in a house and the police subpoena Amazon to get the Alexa recordings just prior to the murder so they can figure out what's going on. So these things are always listening, and now the proof is coming out that they are, because the police are using these audio recordings that are being stored in the cloud on all these devices to help prosecute criminal cases. So the things are listening for everything, not just the keyword, which is either Alexa or Google, Hey Google or Hey Siri. They're constantly listening because they have to take all that audio and slice it and dice it somewhere to find whether or not the activation word should make it work. So I resisted for years getting one of these things. So true story is, my mother-in-law recently entered a assisted living home, and she's hard of hearing, so it's tough to talk to her on a cell phone and get any meaningful conversation out of her. However, what we did do, which we find extremely fascinating but also kind of creepy at the same time, is that my wife and I bought two Echoes. So we have one Echo in our kitchen here in Maryland. The other Echo sits in my mother-in-law's assisted living facility next to her bed in Ohio. And the cool thing with this is that the Echo has something called a drop-in feature. So with whether I use the Echo in my kitchen or I use the Alexa app on my phone, I can say, drop in on my mother-in-law. It will ring a tone in her room, and then immediately I can start listening to everything in the room and have like an intercom conversation. It's almost like a walkie-talkie. So my wife can now talk to her mother and say, hey, Mom, how's it going today? How you feeling? What'd you do? What activities did you attend? And she doesn't have to deal with a cell phone. She just talks to the Echo. And then when she's done, we just terminate the connection. Now, it's convenient. It's perfect for, you know, what my wife and wants to do and check in on her mom in another state without having to use a cell phone. It's perfect for that. But the fact that this thing can listen as much as it does, records all this audio, I find it kind of creepy. So anytime that I'm around, I try and make sure that the microphone is actually turned off. Personally, I have not taken it apart to see if the mute the microphone button actually does mute the mics in the device. I'm hoping Amazon actually is true to their word and they do actually mute the device when I press the button. But so yeah, I've been against these things for years, but then finally acquiesced when mother-in-law went to an assisted living, and it just makes communication so much easier. So I try and be careful what I say around it, or at least make sure that the microphone is muted during the normal course of business around our house. But it is a challenge to, you know, adopt some of this technology and still be secure at the same time. There's just so much more work that you have to do to make sure that these things are secure.
Wow. Yeah, so now another question I want to ask about the cyber threat landscape is, in fact, I've got a new book coming on this. I'm going to be starting to retry it this fall. It is on cybersecurity insurance policies. Has Reform Labs dealt with that with their clients? Because it's a big thing coming out right now. Huh?
I'll tell you what we have done. We were in London last February talking to Aon, one of the world's largest insurers, over there for 2 weeks to talk to them about cyber insurance and how our company and platform might be able to play a role in the underwriting process of cyber policies. And I was kind of shocked at the end of 2 weeks what I learned. And what I learned is this. All of the cybersecurity insurance and policies that exist out there today, again, are all reactionary. They only kick in most cases, when there's been a breach, data has been compromised, and the policies go to help clean up, remediate, and call in and pay for a PR firm to make sure that, brand damage is limited to as much as possible. And then to make sure that you provide your customers a year or two's worth of free credit monitoring. So all these – and when I ask Aon underwriters how they go about determining whether or not to underwrite a particular customer and then how they determine their premiums, I was shocked. They don't even engage in a pen test. They don't even talk to the people. In most cases, cyber policies are the result of somebody in the company filling out a simple questionnaire. And then the underwriters make their decisions based on that. And I was just awestruck by the fact that they don't even do a simple external penetration test of the company to see where the vulnerabilities might be, and then maybe rate their policy coverage and premium according to the types of vulnerabilities that are discovered, at least from an external point of view. But I think the insurance industry has a long way to go to provide true, meaningful, impactful cyber insurance, because right now it's just reactionary. Imagine what a policy or a cyber insurance product would look like if they actually took the time to do an external pen test, come in and do an internal pen test, try and simulate some phishing attacks. You name it. I mean, they don't do anything at all.
Now, that's
to justify.
That's weird, because I thought these insurance companies were doing these kinds of things, at least the big ones. You know, because they have to have, like, certain standards to make sure that their client's not, like, a huge, huge risk. You know what I mean?
Well, I can speak for my interactions with Aon in London and a couple other providers over there. This was February of last year. This is not what they're currently doing, even though I said that they should be doing it, and then –
Well, I can have you as a contributor to this book on cyber insurance. You can shed some insight into that. It's really alarming. I really thought that they did some kind of, formal, some baseline testing or something. But, it's kind of odd. Well, as we approach the last 10 minutes of our show, Terry, just a couple more questions here. From your experience and knowledge, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be in 2020, and how do you think the threat landscape is going to change in this coming decade?
I think that you're going to see a significant rise in IoT attacks, and that will be spawned by, or I should say it will be influenced by, how rapidly this country adopts 5G. Because 5G is going to allow more and more of these IoT devices to connect seamlessly to the internet at much higher rates of speed than they are today. And that speed and massive amount of connectivity is going to spur the nefarious people out there to leverage that platform to launch more devastating attacks. Now, as I mentioned, most of these devices that we look at suffer from simply poor coding practices and outdated, already vulnerable pieces of open source code that they shouldn't be using. And the problem, I think, with a lot of IoT device manufacturers and vendors is that it's speed to market. The quicker I can get these cheap products out to the market, the faster I might be able to grab some market share. So if you're going to be moving that fast to get products out, where are you taking the time to actually make sure it's built securely from the get-go? You're not. And most people, even today, are not focused on security of IoT devices because it just hasn't made major headlines yet. It's not like, a nuclear reactor melted down because of some firmware attacks, or a dam broke loose, or a lock busted open on a dam because of a firmware attack. But I'll tell you, once something like that happens, everybody will know what firmware is, and it will become the dominating topic that needs to be discussed, and security will then become front and center for these IoT devices. But until that time comes, I mean, companies like us and the others I mentioned in the firmware space, you know, we're going to plod along. Some of us might struggle. Some of us may succeed. But until a newsworthy, headline-grabbing event says that a particular outcome or an attack was the result of insecure firmware, it's really not going to be on people's radar until that time comes. But I think 5G, the deployment and rollout of that across this country, with more and more of these IoT devices taking advantage of that speed and connectivity, I'm willing to bet we're going to see an uptick in more attacks with IoT devices and against IoT devices.
Well, what do you think about critical infrastructure? Because I think we're going to see like another 9-11. I mean, I hate to say this, and I don't like saying it, but I think we could see like another 9-11 attack, you know, on our critical infrastructure. Now, it won't be planes crashing through buildings, but it will be like, you know, our water supply shut off for weeks, the national power grid. What do you think about that? Do you think we could see that this year or coming in the coming years? Or?
Well, I don't think we're going to see that probably anytime soon. But let me just say this. There are enough stories out there in the media that, and I think even DHS has admitted this, that the Russians are already in a number of our power plants, and maybe specifically nuclear power plants. So they're just biding their time, waiting to pull the virtual trigger, if you will. Now, I don't think that any rational country would, you know, purposely release the locks of a dam, flood a small town, take out people, or, you know, melt down a nuclear power plant or something like that. I think being able in a negotiation and in a political sense, be able to say, look, if I don't get my way, this is what I can do. And just being able to flex those muscles from a nation state point of view, and the victim, in this case, the United States, already know it and admit to it, I think that gives the other side significant leverage in getting whatever it is that they want. Will we ever see a all-out war where critical infrastructure is taken out? I don't know if that'll happen in this country. I can see it happening in smaller countries, where I think we had something similar happen in Ukraine many years ago by the Russians testing some of their capabilities, taking out some of the critical infrastructure in the Ukraine, made life miserable for about a month, I think, before they were able to get their stuff cleaned up. I think you'll probably see it on a much smaller scale, but I don't think you'll see Iran attacking the United States and causing mass casualties, or vice versa, or us doing that to anybody else. I think they might be in a position to show you that they're there by causing some slight disruptions, but I don't think anything on the scale where you know, there's going to be mass casualties and death and destruction and stuff like that. I think it's going to be more of a negotiating tactic from a political standpoint.
Wow. Well, we'll save the best question for last here. Do you have a laundry list that you tell people how to protect themselves from a cyber attack or businesses? Do you have, like, top two or three
to use?
Yeah, please go over them.
Yeah, the easiest thing is don't click on links and emails. I don't care who they're from. That's number one. That's the number one attack vector for most of these companies that are experiencing theft of intellectual property and customer data and things like that is just people clicking on links. If you can avoid that, that's going to go a long way in protecting yourself. The other thing is just common sense. You know, make sure that your systems are up to date, particularly the firmware in a lot of your corporate environment. So there, believe it or not, there are firmware updates for your wireless printers, for your Polycom phone sitting in the boardroom, for the smart TVs that are hanging on your wall in your lobby. All these types of things are attack vectors. All of them are running firmware.
Wow.
And I guarantee you dollars to donuts that the firmware that's running in those devices today, right now, as I speak, have remotely exploitable vulnerabilities that no one has targeted yet. But all of these devices, if you go to the manufacturer's website, probably have an updated version of the firmware that should be applied. Now, I know some IT staffs are probably overstressed and overworked, but not to add any more to their workload, in addition to, you know, Patch Tuesdays from Microsoft, you should be periodically checking and updating the firmware on all your IoT devices and stuff that, you know, are attack vectors that could be a way into your corporate network should somebody find that low-hanging fruit. You know, it's not hard to do. Don't click on links. Make sure all your systems are patched. And if you have IoT devices, like I mentioned, make sure the firmware's patched as well. Those three things alone will go a long way in preventing any type of infiltration or cyber attack against your company.
Okay. Well, Terry, we thank you for your time this afternoon. It was a very insightful and very enlightening podcast. As I said, I've never dealt with someone who's been on the dark side and is now an ethical hacker, if you will, right?
exactly.
It was very, very. Well, I hate to pick on that, but it's just. I think this is such a great marketing ploy, you know. But anyway, so thank you for your time, and we look forward to having you again here in the future. And I think your product is so intriguing. If you want to send over some, you know, PDFs or a PowerPoint, I'll be more than happy to look it to our podcast channel here. Okay.
All right. Sounds like a plan, Robbie. I appreciate the time, my friend.
Thank you. We'll be in touch soon. Take care.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.